Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include J.W. Jung Seed Company, Wollersheim Winery, and Rockweiler Insulation. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from The Hostel Shop in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, helping customers rediscover the joy of cycling with recumbent trikes and offering an on-site test track and miles of trails. More at hostelshop.com.
Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg. When Marvin Gaye released his environmental anthem, Mercy, Mercy Me, in 1971, a groundbreaking battle in this country was nearing a close. A battle that pitted a ragtag team of poorly funded, ordinary people, garden club ladies, bird watchers, normally timid and cautious university scientists, a few flamboyant attorneys, and a handful of persistent, pesky newspaper reporters against big agriculture and the giant chemical industry. And the ordinary people won. It's a story that happened right here in Wisconsin, because it was in this state that a chemical that was viewed as a miracle pesticide, DDT, was put on trial for pollution of our waterways and for decimating our native birds, from our tiny songbirds to our mighty and majestic eagles. It was in 1970 that Wisconsin banned DDT. And then the first Earth Day, championed by Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson, happened later that year. And with Marvin Gaye's anthem on the radio, a federal ban would follow in 1972. Our guest today, Central Wisconsin conservation writer Bill Berry, author of a new book, Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way, a book that reflects on the past with a message for the present day. Ordinary people, without money or influence, can make a difference and can change history. Later in the program, we'll be joined by a longtime friend of this show, Marge Gibson of the Raptor Education Group, which is a wildlife rehabilitation center in Antigo. She'll be talking about how DDT almost wiped out our eagle population and about the threats that our birds and wildlife still face today. We'd like you to join the conversation as well. Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742 if you remember those days, or if you're concerned about some of the challenges our wildlife face even today. More than 50 years later, that's 1-800-780-9742, or you can put a comment or question on our Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it on the air. Now, we'd like to start out with a personal note on another subject. Many of our listeners recall the program we did with Chester Nez, the last of the original Navajo Code Talkers, last year, when he visited Central Wisconsin through the Edgar School District's A Walk in Their Shoes program. Chester Nez, as you may recall, served in the military during World War II and fought in harrowing conditions on the islands of the Pacific. It was his native Navajo language that was used as an unbreakable code for communications between our soldiers, a code that ultimately was crucial in defeating the Japanese in the Pacific. Chester Nez served proudly in the U.S. military, even though our government tried to wipe out his culture and his language when he was a young boy. That, of course, was before the government discovered how useful that language and culture could be to the U.S. military. Chester Nez died Wednesday at his home in Albuquerque at the age of 93. Bill Berry, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Glenn. It's great to be here.
Why did you write the book?
Well, I wrote the book because it struck me as a story that really needed to be shared, and it seems as current today as it was back in the 1960s. I had my own personal experiences, as you know, with DDT, as growing up in Green Bay and watching the big trucks roll down the street spraying an emulsion with DDT 50 feet up in the air, and some personal memories from that. But really set me off, Glenn, was writing a biography for scientist Joseph Hickey for the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame. As you know, he played a big role in this whole matter.
Well, who do you hope reads this book today? I mean, to a lot of young people, it's going to seem like ancient history to them. These are battles that were fought more than 50 years ago. Who do you hope reads it today, and what message do you want them to get?
Well, as you said so well at the outset here, Glenn, I think it's a story of how citizens can make a difference. And I think our young people today need to visit moments in history to be reminded of the fact that they can make a difference. And citizen activism is a good thing. It's, in that sense, this is a story as much about citizen activism as the chemical DDT. So I would hope engaged citizens, interested citizens, obviously people interested in the environment would all be able to take something away from the book.
We think of young people as being so apathetic. It's a group that doesn't vote. They don't get involved in politics. Many of them will tell you that it doesn't matter who you vote for. Nothing will change. Is this a message for them?
Certainly is. I say that we don't want our youth to be agnostic about what's going on in the world. And so I think that this book is one small way that can open up some ideas for them. And, you know, it reminds us that people can work within the government structure to make changes. These citizens used government as a way to make changes.
And there were powerful interests that they fought against, and they weren't well-funded. They didn't have a lot of support behind them. They kind of did it by themselves. They took on the big chemical industry, big agriculture, and the politicians that were getting a lot of money from those folks.
They did, and that's one of the beauties of the story is that they really had nothing to begin with. I mean, the Citizens Natural Resources Association in Wisconsin was the group that really brought this issue to the forefront. They linked up with the Environmental Defense Fund, a New York group, and neither one of them had any money. Fortunately, they had some connections. There were some people. It was such an interesting time. I mean, one of the major donors to the cause in Wisconsin was a banker, Jack Pulicker from the M&I Bank in Milwaukee. So they were able to tap into these people who saw what something was going wrong and they needed some help. No one got paid to do any of the work. Victor Yannicone, the attorney for the Environmental Defense Fund, got a little bit of money, but basically it was pro bono.
And that campaign, as it unfolded in Wisconsin, got so much publicity that one pundit said the letters DDT got more attention in the media than any other three letters, with the exception of SEX.
Right. Yeah. And the record shows that. I did a lot of research, obviously, for the book, and I was impressed with how vibrant the media was in that era. Newspapers were well staffed. We were able to cover a whole range of issues. By this time, most newspapers are moving into covering the environment as a regular beat. And obviously, TV and radio news operations were strong. TV was coming on real strong. It was a vibrant time for the media in history.
And you mentioned Victor Yannicone.
Yannicone, right.
Yannicone, okay.
Right.
The attorney for the Environmental Defense Fund. He wrote, this is a quote, "Wisconsin was one of the few places that hearing could have taken place. The political climate there was right for it."
Right.
Explain that.
Well, we had Gaylord Nelson just elected to be a U.S. senator. He had been the governor in the state and had connected with Wisconsin's rich conservation heritage and created a lot of laws that really addressed environmental issues. We had a Republican governor, Warren Knowles, who was a conservationist. Both Knowles and Nelson are the namesakes of the Stewardship Fund in Wisconsin today, which funds the acquisition of important lands. Warren Knowles is in the Conservation Hall of Fame, as is Nelson. So it was, and by the way, we had a very young lawmaker named Dave Obey, who was elected in a special election in 1969, went to Congress and immediately started working on DDT.
You know, and we forget that conservation and protection of the environment used to be a bipartisan a concern back in those days. Now, let's look at the person that Dave Obey defeated. He defeated Walter John Chilson, who wrote a column not too long ago, a great Republican leader in central Wisconsin, wrote a column that said conservatives should be conservationists too.
Well, Walter John, when I was a Cub reporter, working at the Wausau Daily Herald, it was always a pleasure to interview Walter John. He was always a gentleman and truly a moderate. And you're right. You know, conservation in the history of the state always managed to rise above partisan politics. I hope we get back to that.
Well, let's just touch on the hearing. I want to get into it in more detail, but for folks who aren't aware of it, and that's what the book is all about, tell us about the hearing, how it was organized, how long it took, how many people testified, how much information was gathered.
Well, Glenna, Wisconsin, one of the reasons Victor Yannacone, the attorney for the Environmental Defense Fund, said Wisconsin was a key place, was that Wisconsin has an administrative law structure, which allows citizens to challenge what the government is doing. I just came from an administrative hearing in Waupaca a couple days ago on the abandonment of a dam. People on both sides of the issue fighting or making their case. And Wisconsin's administrative law allows that to happen. And that's what the environmentalists used in the 1960s. They used Wisconsin administrative law structure. Mm-hmm. And so they challenged the use of DDT on the grounds that it was polluting the state's waters. And so that's what really opened the door to them.
That was the hook. They weren't talking about spraying and dead birds and all of that. It was the pollution of the waters that allowed this to become a statewide issue.
Exactly. And that's really what propelled the issue forward. As you look at what happened, songbirds were dying. We didn't really make the connection with the larger birds, the raptors, on the upper end of the food chain for a while. But we did suddenly learn in about 1967, that basically every waterway in the state of Wisconsin had concentrations of DDT. And so that was the hook that the citizens used. The administrative hearing began in December of 1968. On and off, it continued for about 6 months. Thousands of pages of testimony. Dozens of scientists from all across the country testified. Chemical industry representatives testified. Average citizens. The first person, of course, to testify was Gaylord Nelson. That was a strategy, obviously, that the environmentalists used quite well. But it was an ongoing hearing, and I followed the work of Whitney Gould, a reporter at the Capital Times in Madison, who covered it from gavel to gavel and did a tremendous job. I mean, this was a complicated story. All of a sudden, we're talking about ecology in the 1960s. It wasn't a common subject at the time, so she had a difficult job of explaining, you know, the nuances and the complexities of this issue to average readers.
And how long did the hearing last?
Lasted 6 months. December of 1968, it wrapped up late May of 1969.
And when was the ban signed into law in Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin, the citizen activists in Wisconsin were very disappointed that they weren't the first state to ban DDT. Michigan beat them to the punch, so to speak, and they weren't real happy about it. But Wisconsin banned DDT in 1970. And by the way, Wisconsin, both the Senate and Assembly voted on that. The Assembly voted unanimously. And we were a pretty purple state at that time. We had Republicans and Democrats and fairly well distributed throughout our government.
And that again brings back the fact that protection of the environment, conservation, was and should be a bipartisan issue.
You bet. We've strayed from that a little bit, but I think there are examples out there today of where bipartisanship has promoted good conservation.
Now, in the preface, and you touched on this briefly, you wrote that an episode in your childhood growing up in a working-class neighborhood in Green Bay got you interested in DDT. Tell us about that. Tell us what it was like. Bring us back to that time.
Well, you know, I was just a guy playing basketball and going to high school in those days. But I do remember my family was very interested in the news. We always had two or three newspapers around, and DDT was in the news then. So I do remember as a young person, the DDT crews coming down the streets at night, yellow lights swirling, PA systems telling you portable PA systems telling you, go indoors, we're spraying DDT to try to fight Dutch elm disease. And so it was a kind of an eerie scene as the trucks moved down the streets. They propelled this emulsion way to the top of these elm trees, 60 feet tall sometimes. And so they just literally doused the trees with DDT. Well, as soon as the trucks went past, a block down the road, I went back outside to shoot baskets by my garage, which was 50 feet behind the house. And I noticed that in three elm trees that were along the side of the garage, thousands of birds had congregated there. And, you know, I hate to anthropomorphize, but they sounded like they were really frightened. They certainly were, something had caused them great distress. And they had been prisoners in their nest and in their in the trees at night, and they were sprayed, and they had moved to these trees, which were DDT free.
Well, I have a pet bird, and believe me, that bird experiences the emotion of fear.
Yeah.
And anyone who owns a dog or a cat knows the same thing.
Well, it sure sounded like fear to me, and it made an impression on me that, you know, it's one of those things in life that you just don't forget.
Now, I remember those DDT trucks going through my neighborhood in suburban Chicago back in the 1960s. We didn't have elm trees, but they were spraying in order to control mosquitoes. I remember the streets and lawns filling up with this thick gray fog from the back of these trucks, and I remember my friends thought it was cool. And I also remember that we didn't go inside. We ran outside, and we literally rode our bikes through the DDT fog following the truck through the neighborhood. And I think that was not an uncommon occurrence in a lot of cities.
I can't tell you, Glenn, in working on this book, how many times people told me exactly that. We used to dance in the DDT fog, they said. We used to ride our bikes behind it. It was a pretty common thing, and I guess we didn't know any better.
Well, if DDT is so dangerous, why didn't we get sick?
That's a very good question, and to this day, there will be people who will say we should have no problem using DDT. It hasn't been linked to anything directly in terms of human health. But you know, there's studies, there are numerous studies that have linked DDT and other pesticides to human health issues. A recent study shows that DDT is actually linked to Alzheimer's disease. The first time that they've ever been able to establish, science has ever been able to establish an environmental connection to Alzheimer's disease.
So maybe we didn't get sick right away, but maybe those lingering health hazards have been with us throughout our lives.
Sublethal doses, DDT and many other chemicals are endocrine disruptors. What they do is basically disrupt the hormonal functions in our bodies. So, you know, DDT has been linked to, as I said, Alzheimer's disease, to autism, to Parkinson's disease, and cancer, reproductive problems, quite clearly linked to certain reproductive problems, a range of issues that, you know, endocrine disruptors are linked to.
Well, we'll talk about Dutch elm disease and what that was doing to our tree-lined streets back in the 1950s.
It's an important point, Glenn, because I don't know that we would have that the citizens of Wisconsin would have ever have moved to ban DDT had it not been for this problem with Dutch elm disease. Those of us who lived in the era of beautiful elm tree-lined streets remember their cathedral-like formations. They were great trees. They were very tolerant of pollution and urban environments. So we planted them as monocultures across the eastern United States. Well, in the 1930s, a little fungus arrived, a gift from Europe, I guess, called Dutch elm disease fungus, and it was spread by elm bark beetles, both native and European beetles. And it ravaged elm trees across the country. This is a big problem, and one of the two ways that Dutch elm disease was dealt with was sanitation. In other words, you had to cut the trees down, remove them, dispose of them, burn them, do whatever you could to sort of limit the spread. So huge impact on city budgets across communities across the eastern United States. Then came DDT. All of a sudden, we had this miracle pesticide that we thought was going to solve our problems. It did reduce Dutch elm disease, the spread of Dutch elm disease, did not eliminate it. And I talked to city foresters, including Tim Lang, who was a city forester in Green Bay at the time.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, it didn't matter. We were fighting a losing battle. So that was the important link, because when the DDT was used to spray Dutch elms disease trees, what happened was acute poisoning of songbirds. So we suddenly saw songbirds dying all around us.
So the first people to raise the alarm were people back then that we didn't view as radicals or activists, garden club ladies and bird watchers, you know.
Exactly.
Harmless folks.
One of them, Bertha Pearson from Wausau, who was a secretary treasurer of Marathon Box Company, a tremendous community leader in her time. She was in her late 70s at the time of the DDT hearings and an officer with Citizens Natural Resources Association. I mean, they were called names. They were called food faddists and environmental radicals and a whole bunch of other names. But I don't think anyone who knew Bertha Pearson would have considered her a radical.
She was a businesswoman.
She was a businesswoman and a really good one. And she was also a great community leader, helped establish the HOM home for boys in Wittenberg, the Visiting Nurses Association in Marathon County. Just a top-notch citizen.
Well, let's look at a few of the other players who were involved. And again, your book is full of ordinary people. You're not talking about politicians. Gaylord Nelson is kind of mentioned almost as a footnote. You're focusing on ordinary people and the difference they made. Let's talk about that lady in tennis shoes, Lori Otto.
Lori Otto was a housewife, and I use that term because that's what she called herself, in upscale village of Bayside in the Milwaukee area. Her husband ran a psychiatric hospital in Waukesha, she's probably as well known for DDT or for her native planting and prairie enthusiasm as for DDT. So Lori Otto, housewife, started to notice that birds were dying in her yard. She made the connection to DDT pretty quickly because she saw the effects of what was happening there. And so at one point she put 20 some robins in a basket and took them over to the village of Bayside Hall and put them in front of the officers there and said, "What are you going to do about this?" And their response was, "What do you want, lady? Birds or trees?"
Birds or trees. And that wasn't uncommon. You also write that, you know, people were delivering baskets of dead robins as unwanted gifts to local public officials all over the state, including farm historian Jerry Apps,
That's
who was
right.
the Brown County UW Extension agent.
That's right. Jerry remembered that very clearly. It was a difficult, they asked him, "What are you going to do?" And it was a difficult point for Jerry, because I believe he belonged to the Audubon Society there in Green Bay at the time. And yet Extension was promoting the use of DDT for gardening and home uses at the time.
Now, there were university scientists who got involved reluctantly because they didn't see their role as advocates, Joseph Hickey and Dan Anderson.
Joseph Hickey was a real hero of this story, and probably a fascinating story that could be shared in another book. I mean, he was about as reluctant as anyone to get involved with the public, in the public forum. He was a scientist. He believed scientists belonged in the laboratory, and he was older than the other activists who were involved. I think he was around 60 years old at the time of the DDT hearings, very reluctant to get involved, but he just knew that something was wrong. It was his research on robins dying in the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus that sort of helped kickstart the citizen activism. And then it was Hickey who made the connection between DDT and the dramatic declines in raptor populations.
And we're going to have Marge Gibson on in a few minutes
to
talk about that. But some of the other people who got involved, wildlife artists like Owen Grammy and his son Roy. And there's a permanent Owen Grammy exhibit right now at the Woodson Museum here in Wausau.
There is. And Owen Grammy was I always like to say he was like the character who's like an intersection of art and nature and conservation activism. He was a conservation activist throughout his life, and he's very adamant. When he thought he was right, he was going to tell you so. And he said, "I am right, and I know I'm right." He was widely credited with helping to save the Horicon Marsh from draining and turning it into agricultural land.
Frederick Ott, a Milwaukee businessman, Charles Chappie Fox of the Circus World Museum, not the kind of folks that you would think would get involved in an environmental cause. And then you had these militant, flamboyant attorneys from the Environmental Defense Fund, a few of them, and their motto was very succinct.
Can I say what it
yes,
was?
Yes, you can go ahead and say
Well, their motto early on was Sue the Bastards. And it, what it did, it was reflected a concern among citizens at the time that nothing was happening to change the pollution of our air and water, the indiscriminate use of pesticides. And so they said they used that motto and they meant it. They were going to sue people. And they sure did.
And then you mentioned the reporters already, the Capital Times, the aggressive young reporter Whitney Gould. But Wisconsin Public Radio also got involved in the fray when Carl Schmidt, on the normally uncontroversial show Chapter a Day, decided to read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring on the air.
The silky voice of Carl Schmidt. And it created a tremendous controversy because when he read that book, the entomology staff at the College of Agriculture at UW-Madison protested with a lengthy 20-page document that was sent to the university chancellor, basically asking him to fire Carl Schmidt or at least keep him down. and so it became a dramatic. Of course, then the scientists the young scientists at UW-Madison who were active and concerned about pesticides, they fired back. So we had this volley of correspondence going back and forth.
And Carl Schmidt didn't back down.
He did not back down, nor did public radio. And so, you know, one important point there is that a lot of this was not even known publicly at the time. A lot of this went behind the scenes. Fortunately, Lori Otto kept every single stitch of paper she ever put her hand on, 8 boxes of archival material housed with the Wisconsin Historical Society. And so this is the part of the story that came out from what Lori Otto had archived.
And we had a split going on there in the University of Wisconsin system, Wisconsin Public Radio at the time, and still is part of the University of Wisconsin. You had a split with them, the natural resources people, the College of Letters and Sciences, and then the folks at the College of Agriculture and the Entomology Department who thought we ought to be using these chemicals.
Yeah, it was a really interesting moment. And there's a motto, I think, of Bascom Hall over there at Madison that says the sifting and winnowing of ideas is what a university is about. I guess we were sifting and winnowing, but we were also throwing some punches along the way.
Bill Berry, he's the author of a new book called Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe you remember those days, maybe you're concerned about existing threats to our environment, existing threats that are being fought by some people in the same way that those people fought to keep DDT back in the 60s. 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. Or you can put a note on our Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We'll be back with Marge Gibson of the Raptor Education Group right after this.
From the fountains and the mountains comes the water running cool and clear and blue. And it flows down from the hills, and it goes down to the towns and passes through. When it gets down to the cities, then the water turns into a dirty gray. It's poisoned and polluted by the people as it flows along its way. Don't go near the water, children, see the fish all dead up on the shore. Don't go near the water. Water isn't water anymore.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics, Access Prosthetics, and Gimme Shelter play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can too. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Wausau's Woodson Art Museum, presenting exhibitions featuring upcycled couture fashion and fiber arts on view through June 15th. Details about how to repurpose and reimagine everyday items at lywam.org.
White bird must fly, or she will die. White bird must fly, or she will die.
If you just joined us on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio, we're talking about the chemical DDT and its effect on birds and wildlife, and a group of citizen activists in Wisconsin who got the chemical banned in the late 60s and started the environmental movement across the entire nation in the process. Bill Berry, author from Stevens Point, wrote the book Banning DDT, and he is with us, as is Marge Gibson, who is the person who runs the Raptor Education Group Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in rural Antigo. Marge Gibson, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. This is a great conversation.
Give us your reaction to it, since you've been listening on the phone this whole time.
Well, I was a young college student when all this was going down in Wisconsin in the early or mid-1960s. And I was just incredibly proud of my state. I was going to school in Minnesota at the time, for their initiative to take this on and to try to make a difference. And as Bill was saying, you know, these were people that were everyday people and not scientists, but they really had the will to make a difference. And I was naive enough to think at that time that I could make a difference. I think apathy wasn't part of our vocabulary in the day.
Well, you're not naive, and you are making a difference. Your organization has been well known for its rehabilitation of raptors, bald eagles, hawks, owls, and so on. But you take care of all kinds of birds. How many birds do you take care of every year at the Raptor Education Group in Antigo?
We care for about 1,000. Sometimes, you know, not quite 900 and some, and sometimes a little over, depending on the year. But it's roughly about 1,000 a year.
And we have a pretty healthy bald eagle population in the state now, but that wasn't the case back in the 60s when DDT was widely used.
Absolutely. In fact, this time, in 2013-2014, we care for about 100 bald eagles a year here at Raptor Education Group. But I think any of us that lived in the state in the 1960s remember there were very few bald eagles, and you really didn't see them. And I think that that's the comment that I get more often when people see bald eagles now. They're just so very excited. But if they lived through that period in the 1960s, they're even more excited because they weren't around. We only had about 470 pair in 1963, and that was in the entire country.
And I remember, going up north to Presque Isle with my folks back in the 60s. I've told this story on the air before. And I remember pulling the car over, and there was a whole group of people in a line of cars, and they were all looking way up in the air at this little dot circling up there. And lo and behold, it was a bald eagle. And I remember what an unusual and strange sight that was. And now you see bald eagles everywhere in Wisconsin. The turnaround has really been amazing, and it's got to be banning DDT has had to have something to do with that.
Banning DDT has had an awful lot to do with it. The heavy-bodied birds, like the brown pelican, which we don't have in our state, but osprey, which we do have in our state, and bald eagles, when they would sit on their nests, the eggshells would be so thin that they would break them, and so the reproduction couldn't take place without the eggs hatching. And so our numbers were going down, not only because of any other effects that humans have on wildlife populations, which are many, but also they weren't able to replace themselves because their eggs didn't hatch because the shells were too thin. And people were beginning to notice, and I think back in the day, especially people, and I'm so proud of our state because especially people in the Midwest and in Wisconsin were so proud of the wildlife that we have here and our waterways and all the natural resources that we have here, and it's one of the reasons they live here. And to see it downgrade was just something that they felt they couldn't tolerate. They took this on, which was amazing.
And Bill Berry, it was Joseph Hickey who drew up that link between DDT and the thinning eggshells.
Right, Glenn, and it took a while. As Marge said, the large raptors experienced dramatic population declines, but not for the same reason that songbirds were dying. Songbirds died from acute toxicity. The raptors were affected by sublethal doses. They were unable to, which were the concentrated DDT and its metabolites in their fatty tissues, and were unable to produce enough calcium to produce strong eggs. So as Marge said, there was a decline, but it took a while. That's a part of this book that I found a lot of fun to report about, because it was like a mystery. And scientists in 1965, Joseph Hickey has a peregrine falcon conference in Madison. Why? Because a peregrine falcon was in decline, and that was a bird that he knew a lot about. Scientists from all over the country and Europe came here, and they still were unsure about what was causing this dramatic decline in birds. There were a whole bunch of possible causes, everything from egg collectors to hunters, and disease was considered to be a factor. We didn't know. And so it was a mystery that they had to solve before they could really prove their point.
And Marge Gibson, peregrine falcons were almost wiped out, and these are majestic birds, fastest bird alive. They can go 200 miles an hour.
Absolutely, they really were. And I think it was in part, we have another hero, Dr. Tom Cade, who is a professor from Cornell University and is now with the Peregrine Fund. And the falconers, who are common people, again, who practice the art of falconry and use falcons, use peregrines, realized that their numbers were just almost non-existent. And they took up the fight as well. So we had people coming from all sides, and the peregrines were definitely one of the reasons that people were interested and tried to preserve that population and get them back to where they belong.
Yet, Bill Berry, you write that there were naysayers who mocked Silent Spring as pseudoscience. And in 1973, a lady named Rita Gray Beatty wrote a book called DDT Myth, Triumph of the Amateurs. And you quote her, she wrote, "Peregrine falcons are a weed species, commonly called the duck hawk." And you say her point was that even if DDT impacted some species, they weren't worth worrying about.
That's right. That's what she wrote. And, you know, some people still feel that way about the other creatures we share the earth with. It was kind of a parochial view, really, because on one hand, this author was saying that DDT wasn't causing harm, but even if it did, we don't care because a peregrine falcon was unimportant.
And this is a chemical that persists in the environment and goes up the food chain. And Marge Gibson, that's how it affects the bigger raptors.
Right, it does. And, you know, it's in our soil for at least 12 years. And, you know, anything that persists for that long, I think we have to be aware of and be concerned about, because it's not as if you can just, you know, make it go away tomorrow. And when we look at peregrines or any of the bird populations, their reproductive cycle was undermined in many ways, but their generations move much more quickly than ours do. So what we find in their generations, you know, we can expect to find in ours, but perhaps a long ways down the road. It's only been 44 years since DDT was banned in our state, and you know, that's not a long time. That's not even a lifetime in human terms. And in fact, I have a bald eagle that's that age as well. So, but I think you know, it's short-sighted to think that there's no effect. I remember
now birds also, Marge Gibson, they don't respect state boundaries or international boundaries. Are other countries still using DDT or other chemicals that might be just as harmful?
They are. South America certainly uses it. Central America, Mexico still uses it. And it has been reproduced here in our country under different names with a slightly different variant. But when our birds go to migrate down to South America, including the osprey, they do pick it up. And levels are determined, especially on the West Coast, Catalina Island, for instance, in their bald eagle populations and the gulls that are returning to that area from South America.
Bill Berry, you write that screech owls were wiped out on the UW-Madison campus where DDT had been sprayed, and it happened only after rainstorms.
Right. Well, it was, as you know, Glenn, rainstorms make earthworms rise to the surface. Earthworms contain concentrations of DDT. The screech owls ate those earthworms and died pretty rapidly from acute exposure.
We have a question on our Facebook page. Michael from Merrill was actually on the phone but had to drop off. And he's wondering if small towns also spray DDT. He grew up in Athens His father died of cancer. His mother developed Alzheimer's. Could there be a connection?
Well, Glenn, I talked to, it's an interesting question. I talked to someone who grew up in the Wausau area just a couple of weeks ago who said that DDT was sprayed pretty extensively in parts of Marathon County as a mosquito control, tool. So I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if it had been used, in small towns, probably not to the extent of major D Dutch elm disease efforts in larger cities, but it was used as a control of nuisance mosquitoes.
And as you were mentioning, how do you know if something is linked to it when the effects don't develop and show themselves for many years?
Right. Well, as Marge pointed out, that was the case with raptors. We didn't know that they were being impacted for DDT for years because they're longer lived than some of the other species, and it took a while for us to figure it out. So, you know, I hear a lot of anecdotal comments. I was contacted by a doctor in Dodgeville recently, a retired medical doctor, who said, "I appreciated your book, and I just wanted to tell you a story. I work for the city of Madison. We sprayed DDT all summer for mosquito control, and every one of the young men, there were six young guys, every one of those guys on that mosquito control patrol developed tremors from acute exposure. So he's a strong believer in the need to address issues like this.
Now, we talked about the conflict between UW-Madison's School of Agriculture and the natural resources people and the College of Letters and Science, but there's also a conflict between old line conservation groups like the Isaac Walton League and the more militant organizations like the CNRA.
Right. Matter of fact, Isaac Walton League really opposed the formation of this Citizens Natural Resources Association in the 1950s. They said, you know, why don't you just join us and give us your resources and we'll take care of it. It's interesting that the CNRA is a reflection, and the Environmental Defense Fund are sort of a reflection of the modern environmental movement in, I think, one key way. And that is that women were more active in these groups. And the storyline throughout the book sort of stresses that this was a case where women found a home in the modern environmental movement.
And whereas the traditional hook and bullet environmental groups were populated by men and sportsmen.
They were. I must say, though, that even though, you know, there was that split, that Isaac Walton League came together and joined in the petition to challenge the use of DDT in Wisconsin. So they played an important role, because then the hunting and fishing community merged with the modern environmentalists and became a powerful force. And
Marge Gibson, you're a woman who's been active in the environment the whole time. You've seen a change in the role of women and their willingness to become active politically.
It has changed, and it has changed a lot, as a matter of fact. I think initially when women were active, they were mothers. They were protecting their children, which is a biologic need of any female that has youngsters, any parent, actually. But I think that was probably the initial push for women to become responsible and really have that protective situation going with their own youngsters. And now I think that, you know, it became, as the larger political groups started forming and the big money chemical groups and things took over, it was more and more difficult, has been more and more difficult to make any progress. You know, the powerful lobbyists make it almost impossible in some ways. But back then, it wasn't a matter of money. It was a matter of ethics. It was a matter of doing what was right. And those were words that my father spoke so often that, you know, still runs through my head constantly. Reporters, Bill mentioned too, it was a vibrant media and people acted responsibly. Credibility was really important. And now, you know, it's not quite as important. You know, you can get a different slope on the news with any channel that you turn on. So,
well, and the internet, you know, you can find any fact you want to support your predetermined position, which those of us who deal in facts for a living find that very frustrating. But we were talking about the conservation groups, and you got the hook and bullet people involved because DDT had the potential to destroy Wisconsin's fishery. Bill Berry, you write about Doc Schneeberger. Am I pronouncing the name right?
Right.
He noticed muskie eggs were no longer viable in many waters. And then a quiet guy like Fred Baumgartner of Stevens Point, Wisconsin State University Stevens Point wildlife professor, later UWSP, sounded the alarm. He said, Wisconsin's valuable natural resources of fish, wildlife, and water, as well as the potential economic benefits of both recreation and commercial fisheries, are at stake today.
Right, Glenn, and I think that's an important point right now. As Marge has said, you know, there's a lot of influences on our government today, and many of them have a lot to do with money. One of the things that I think we have not done well in the environmental movement and conservation movement is tie the benefits, the economic benefits of a healthy environment to the argument. We haven't made a strong economic argument.
Well, we're going to touch on that point when we come back. We're way behind here. I've got to squeeze in one more break. We'll be back with Bill Berry, the author of Banning DDT, and Marge Gibson of the Raptor Education Group right after this.
Some senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he who gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging. We'll rattle your windows and shake down your walls. For the times they are a-changing.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Stevens Point Area Co-op, Peninsula Music Festival, and Import Auto Clinic. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Greenwood Hills Country Club, Wausau, helping the community one round at a time with Make a Difference Mondays, a day open for all golfers to enjoy a round of golf while benefiting a Wausau area charity. Details at greenwoodhillscc.com.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
We're back with Bill Berry, the author of Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way, and Marge Gibson of the Raptor Education Group. And this has been too much fun, and we're almost out of time, so we're going to have to kind of cut to the chase here. Bill, you write that the DDT story is a fascinating chapter, one of citizen engagement and activism that in many ways hasn't been replicated in the nearly half century since the story played out.
Right. Well, and it's true. Although I will say that I'm seeing evidence of plenty of citizen activism in the state of Wisconsin in certain environmental battles the last few years, Glenn. But you know, it was a little army of private citizens. They didn't have a lot of money or resources. They had some scientists who decided to get engaged. Wisconsin's conservation tradition was a factor in all this. The administrative law process allowed the hearing to take place. A whole bunch of factors came together.
And Marge Gibson, we are not out of the woods yet. There's still threats to our birds and our wildlife and our rivers and our lakes and our watershed.
There's so many things that are out there that are damaging not only to wildlife but to us and to the world around us. I think one of the things that we need to do better is environmentalists and people who care about the environment tend to it evokes a very strong emotional component. And the one thing we need to really stress is that the economic benefits, the economic component there that that will affect big business, that will affect farming, that will affect hunters and people who like the natural resources and utilize the natural resources for other reasons.
Is climate change the DDT of our era? Despite the science, it's being fought by some powerful moneyed interests.
We're talking to me.
I'm talking to both of you.
Okay. From my perspective, we are seeing some very interesting changes. I'm seeing different groups of birds coming in with different reasons into rehab, and I think that that's, science isn't in yet, but I think it is interesting.
Marge, you're in northern Wisconsin there, and there have been a lot of work done by forest ecologists about the changing nature of the northern forests in the wake of climate change. So that's a big deal in northern Wisconsin, whether people realize it today or not. It's a big issue, Glenn. The problem with climate change is You don't see dead birds laying on the boulevard with climate change. It's a global issue. A little harder for people to focus on a crisis point, and yet there's plenty of evidence that it's doing having dramatic impacts.
Well, those crisis points are coming quicker and quicker all the time, aren't they?
Unfortunately.
They certainly are.
Thanks so much to both of you for being with us, Bill Berry and Marge Gibson. Bill Berry, the author of Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way.
Where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
We want to thank today's guests, Bill Berry, author of Banning DDT, How Citizens Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way, the book published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Also thanks to Marge Gibson of the Raptor Education Group Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Antigo. You can find out more about her organization at raptoreducationgroup.org. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Woody Guthrie, Marvin Gaye, Johnny Cash, It's a Beautiful Day, The Byrds, Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and the Original Wailers, and Janet Planet. Next week on Route 51, we preview the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair, which will take place during the summer solstice weekend in Custer, Wisconsin, near Stevens Point. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.
Seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.